impulsively and takes my hand in a death grip. She's biting her bottom lip, holding back tears. She studies my left hand, and a look of relief crosses her face. My moniker still shines silver. My brother is alive. Balmora wipes away a tear. Who would do this? She demands. It could be any number of factions. Retribution from the Rose Gardeners for the social club. The Virtue's response to my mother's bid for power. The Gates of Dawn. Then I think about Raken. Did he know? Is that why he didn't want me to watch? Or was he just trying to protect me from more sorrow? I sink into a silk lounge chair. Another massacre. Balmora joins me on the long cushion, still holding my left hand. Her eyes keep darting to it. The announcers are at a loss for what to say. No one knows exactly what happened, except that an explosion went off along the route to the memorial. Footsteps approach Balmora's room. A few of her second-born attendants storm in, young women in elegant sundresses with flushed faces. Quincy seems flustered, wringing her hands. "Get out! All of you!" Balmora screams. Their retreat is hasty, and they close the double doors behind them in a flurry. Neither of us speaks. Time is strange. Sometimes it doesn't exist. The two of us stare, waiting for the clouds of smoke to clear enough for us to see the damage. I think I experience every kind of emotion there is to feel. Survival guilt threatens to choke me. None of this would be happening if I died on my transition day. Another part of me exults in supreme satisfaction that my mother's attack against me is being avenged. A part of me died that day, and I've never fully mourned its loss. Shame and disloyalty tangle with the realization that I truly, deeply, want my mother dead. The smoke finally dissipates, uncovering horrific carnage. In a replay of the events leading up to the attack, a glass hearse hovers down the avenue. Nothing appears to move toward the vehicle. Then it explodes outward. Whatever weapon was used, it was inside the vehicle. The vehicle that carried my father's corpse. The Vicold carrying my mother and my brother mysteriously drops back right before the explosion. The recording doesn't show what happened to them, but I think I already know. It was staged. They knew it would explode. Whatever just happened, it was a political move to further my mother's agenda. And it was personal. She'd rather kill innocent bystanders than allow Kennet inside the St. Sismode tomb. My family is fine, I say numbly. How do you know? Balmora asks. I just do. We continue to watch the aftermath of the attack for almost an hour. A feminine voice at the door rouses me from the holographic nightmare. Roselle, there's a man here to see you. It's Quincy. He's not allowed to enter, so he requested that someone come and fetch you before he levels the building. The sun outside is setting. I've been here for hours. Who is it? I ask in a daze. Firstborn Clifton Salloway. Tell him to go away, Balmora orders. I lurch to my feet and take a step toward the door. It's okay. I need to see him. When are you coming back? Balmora asks, gripping tighter to my left hand, unwilling to let me leave. Her hair is in disarray, ribbons hanging limply on her shoulders. Her eyes dart to my moniker. The stingers in the room react. Their weapons power up noisily. Balmora lets go of my hand when the lethal barrels turn toward her. Don't! I get between one of the stingers and her, and it moves off. Balmora, I'll come back soon, I say, trying to keep my emotions in check, trying not to fall apart. Impulsively, I turn and hug her. I promise. I untangle myself from her and hurry to the door, past the attendant, and through the sunroom made of glass. My stingers trail me. In the hallway, everyone who lives and works in the Sea Fortress seems to be standing around and gossiping. They fall silent when I appear. Where is Firstborn Salloway? I ask. An elderly secondborn with a white roiling wave moniker on her hand points. Thank you, I managed to say, continuing outside and across the courtyard. Clifton leans against the portico with his arms folded over his chest, glowering at the exo guards and death drones hovering nearby. When he sees me, he straightens. My unshed tears blur his features, so I can't tell what he's thinking. I want to say his name, but my throat tightens. When I reach him, he catches me in his arms, hugging me. Roselle, he says softly, like he's addressing a tiny kitten. I came as soon as I could. He takes off his jacket, wraps it around my shoulders, and hugs me again. How did you know where to find me? Bribes, he whispers. I laugh and choke on tears at the same time. His arms shift from my back to my waist. We turn toward the shore. The tide has come in, and the sandbar is covered with water. Clifton's Veringer undulates in the nearby cove, resembling a beautiful swan with its wings up. I brought an extra pair of hover discs for you, but you don't have shoes. No matter. I'll carry you. He reaches under my knees and lifts me with almost no effort. My arms circle his neck, and I lay my head on his shoulder. The stingers don't react at all. Clifton treads out onto the water, walking just above the surface. Why were you at Balmora's? He asks calmly. I shrug and bury my face against his neck. If I speak, I'll sob. He seems to understand. I need to talk to you, but you don't have to say anything. Just listen. I'm going to take you to my airship, all right? I nod. The breeze mists us. Fish swim beneath the surface, some with tiger stripes, some speckled gray and white. The hum of the airship keeps the birds away. I stare toward the shore. Exo guards gather there, pointing at us. The stingers aren't reacting, though. They trail us like faithful hounds. The door opens upward as we near the Veringer. Stinger R0517 and R6492, remain where you are, Clifton orders. To my surprise, they heed his order, halting and hovering above the waves. He carries me over the threshold, and the door closes behind us. Clifton finally sets me down near a fat lounge chair in the airship's great room. He takes a seat and leans toward me. Do you know what just happened? He asks, concern etched in his face. I pull his warm jacket tighter around me. You mean the explosion in Swords? He nods. Yes, I saw the replay. Then you know it wasn't us, right? He's anxious. I swallow down some of my emotion. I know more than that. I know it was my mother. She's probably in her office right now, rehearsing the speech she prepared days ago, condemning the Gates of Dawn for the attack. I doubt she'll be able to shed a real tear, though. Emotion has always been difficult for her. Clifton leans back in his chair, studying me. Your military acumen is exceptional. Maybe. Or maybe I just know Othala. Things cannot continue the way they are now, he warns. You know this. I know. Someone has to stop my mother. She doesn't care about her people, just her power. Clifton glances at the windows behind me. He swears softly. I look over my shoulder to see exo-soldiers manning boats. I came to reassure you. The Virtue has you under his thumb now, but it won't be for long. My eyes meet his. What are you planning? It's better you don't know, he replies. You have control over the stingers following me. It's a fact, not a question. Who do you think made them? The first rule for anything I create is an indefinite moratorium against harming me. The second is a built-in assurance that it follows all my orders. Something about that makes me smile. He really is quite brilliant. The Virtue doesn't see you coming, does he? No, he replies. I will take care of you, Roselle. You won't be a prisoner here much longer. It's hard to know who to trust, I say, almost to myself. You can trust me. Clifton is dangerous, but I'm determined to be dangerous, too. My concern right now is for your welfare. You've been lucky up until now. You defeated your assassins. I want to make sure that trend continues. To that end, we've developed a new fabric we're calling Copper Scale. It's a defensive material. I want you to use it. From now on, all your clothing will be provided by Salloway Munitions. I'll clear it with the Halo Palace until we can make other arrangements. Defensive? How? I ask. We created a textile that acts like armor. It conducts energy away from the wearer, but the fabric is lightweight, and to all outward appearances, you won't look to be wearing anything out of the ordinary. We'll reinforce whatever normal fabric you choose with it. The jacket you're wearing now is made from copper scale. Here, let me show you. He uses his moniker to pull up a holographic display. Footage shows lab demonstrations of tactical munitions being fired at a second-born test subject, wearing what looks like ordinary street clothes. Although the subject survives a fusion mag pulse at close range, he is lifted off his feet and propelled backward several yards. Please tell me you gave him hazard pay, I murmur. He volunteered, Clifton replies, but yes, he was well compensated. It's not perfect. You'd be hurt by a direct fusion mag pulse, but it won't kill you. I run my hand over the sleeve of the jacket. It's a little coarse, but the inside is lined with cashmere, which makes up for it. We can line the inside of your clothing with copper scale and use a different fabric as outerwear, if that suits you better. This jacket won't protect from a headshot, Clifton, unless... I drape the garment over my head like a veil. When I pull it back, I find him grinning. We'll have to learn how to duck, he says. Outside, boats draw up to the Varinger. Someone pounds on the metal door, and the sound echoes through the airship. Clifton growls in anger. I want so badly to be able to talk to him about everything I know, including the Gates of Dawn. I need the Rose Gardeners and the Gates of Dawn to agree to coexist. Can I build a bridge between them? Can the Rose Gardeners change? The mortician is missing, I murmur. I'm sorry, the what is missing? The master mortician who worked on my father's body and prepared him for burial. He went missing, and then my father's hearse blew up. You think this mortician had something to do with it? He asks. I don't know, but Agent Crow was with him. I saw them together. It means something. I just don't know what. More thumps on the door. Clifton clenches his jaw. You're not to go around asking questions about it. I'll look into it. Do nothing. If census agents are involved, this is bigger than the vendetta between my mother and my father. Bigger than the Rose Gardeners. This is an alliance between census and the sword. The thought horrifies me, and it seems to have the same effect on Clifton. I'm serious, Roselle. Not a word to anyone. I'll make inquiries. I was afraid before. Now I'm terrified. I nod in agreement. Impulsively, Clifton leans forward, kisses my forehead, and takes both my hands in his. You'll be safe. I'll make sure of it. He rubs his thumbs over my skin. It reassures me. He's shelter. He rises from his seat and moves to the door. Opening it, he swears at the waiting security outside. An argument breaks out between the lead exo guard and Clifton. I rise from the chair, walk to the entrance, and lay my hand on Clifton's arm. Firstborn Salloway, thank you for the tour of your Varinger. It's really quite lovely. I believe you should definitely make those changes to the dual-blade X-16 that we discussed. I try to hand him back his jacket. Keep it, he says, still scowling at the guards. I step into the boat, Clifton's coat securely around me, and settle between two well-armed exos. The stingers follow us when we pull away from the airship. I stuff my hands in the pockets and find Clifton's cigar case. I pull it from his pocket, and I'm about to ask to go back so I can give it to him, but we've almost made sure, and the Varinger is already in the air. I climb out of the boat and make my way back to my apartment, amid a swarm of bodyguards. I pat Phoenix's head on my way in. Settling onto the sofa in the den, I stare up at the ceiling. Phoenix parks itself in front of me, so I know it's Raken. Fee, can you get me a Krella from the commissary? The Mechadome leaves the room. I shove my hand into the pocket of the jacket and pull out the cigar case. Thin brown cigars, the kind with the scent of roses, lie in a neat row. I check for a secret compartment and find one with a thumbprint scanner. Testing it, I'm surprised when it opens for me. A small holographic screen projects up from the case. Clifton's face, made of blue light, is grinning at me. "Hello," he murmurs. "Do you like your new communicator?" "You could have just given it to me," I reply. "Where's the fun in that?" "I had a bet with my technicians. I said you'd find it in under an hour." I rise from the sofa and carry the communicator with me to the door. Closing the door, I lock it and return to my seat. From inside a compartment of the cigar case, I lift a metallic bracelet and examine it. It's a device that I've seen once before at the briefing after the attack on the Sword Social Club. It's the mirroring technology that reflects whatever moniker it's closest to. Right now, it's showing my moniker, without my crown-shaped birthmark. Clifton notices the device and says, "We're calling that a looking-glass moniker. We're working on reverse engineering it, but that one is an original. We found it on one of the assassins you killed." "Why are you giving it to me, Clifton?" "There may come a time that you'll want to, shall we say, part company with the virtue," he says. "Should that time come, I'd like you to have all the tools you need to take your leave. You'll find codes inside your cigar case that will allow you to take control of your halo stingers, just like I did today." It's just like Clifton to be a few steps ahead of everyone else. "Tell me about the rest, Clifton." Chapter 13. The Bottom of the Sea. Raken wears black. I wear white. We spar with fusion blades, and I imagine it's like watching someone sparring with a shadow. We tangle and fold in on each other. Our swords are dialed down to their lowest training setting, but if they weren't, neither of us would survive. As it is, skin regeneration treatments are required after each interaction in Grisham's sparring circle. We savage each other. I've taken to using protective eyewear when I fight him because he has nearly cut my eyes out on a few occasions. He dons eyewear, too, for the same reason. Neither of us has yet to win a duel. Grisham snorts, watching us. "The sexual tension in here is savage. Find a way to be together so I don't have to be subjected to your mating dance every day." He takes a sip of water, still breathing hard from the training I put him through. He's slowly getting better with his fusion blade. It's been a month since I began training him, and I'm just now losing some of my worry that he'll chop off his own leg. Raken pauses and scowls at Grisham. "She's second born." His tone contains no small amount of disgust. I murder him with my eyes. Grisham takes another sip of water. "Hey, I know it's slumming, but I do see the attraction." A backhanded compliment, the best I can hope for, though it still makes me want to skewer him with my sword. Instead, I walk away, toward Grisham's spa, to get my burns treated. They trail behind me. The sophisticated spa area is just down the hall from the main pool. Its tranquility comes from rough black tile on three of the walls. There isn't a fourth wall. It's just an opening, with an indoor-outdoor pool and pool deck providing a stunning view of the sea. Ocean breezes stir large potted palms. Adam-fated second-born technicians wait for us at hovering medical tables. I change into an emerald bathing suit and join the first-born commander and Raken. Grisham is lying face down on one table, while an attractive female second-born works on the burns I gave him across his back and calves. Raken, bare-chested and attired in a black swimsuit, sits on the opposite table, holding his forearms up to his female attendant. I take the middle table. My attendant is a tall, leggy female, too. Grisham selects them. Like Reikin, my arms need attention, but nothing else.
We're still on for tonight, Grisham says. You're not going to back out on me, are you, Winterstrom?
No, Reikin replies. I'm still in.
And you're coming too, right, Roselle?
I sigh heavily. Do I have a choice?
No, they both say in unison.
You're my slave, Reikin says. We need you to assess the competitors.
Then I'll be at your stupid second-born pre-trial event.
You make it sound horrible, Grisham replies with a chuckle. But it'll be fun.
It is horrible, I retort, if you're on the other side of it, Grisham. Are you sure your father said it's okay for us to go?
The Virtue only just agreed to let the trials move forward. I'd hoped that when Clarity Bowie postponed the second-born trials, it would be indefinitely. It's only been 2 weeks since the chaos of my father's funeral. The Virtue declared a state of mourning, and second-borns slated to be in the trials were shipped back to their fates to resume their duties. Now, apparently, they're all coming back to compete. Well, most. Some of the swords have gone into active duty, or died fighting the Gates of Dawn.
Of course I'm sure, Grisham replies, and I'll wager that, by the end of the evening, you'll place a bet on someone, Roselle.
I bet I won't.
Grisham hisses at his attendant. Are you using a wire brush to scour my skin? Why don't you try numbing it first?
Stop being a baby, Reikin replies with a smirk. You don't hear Roselle crying about her burns.
That's because she has no feelings, Grisham replies. I'm convinced she's a cyborg.
Is that true, Roselle?
Reikin asks with a condescending grin.
Are you a cyborg?
For some reason, his question stings. Maybe it's because it's only one of a handful of words he said to me in the past 2 weeks. He has kept his distance from me since the night I last saw Hawthorne. Reikin and I see each other almost every day, at training or in council meetings, but he never comes to my apartment anymore. At least, I don't think he does. I've awoken a few times and thought I heard the door close. And sometimes, I think I smell his scent when I wake up, or see the indention of his shape in the chair by my bed, but I can't be sure.
Sometimes I wish I was, I reply, but I can assure you that I do think for myself, and my heart is my own.
As soon as my skin is repaired, I slide off the table and go to the tranquil pool. I wade down the stone steps, plunge beneath the surface, and swim underwater to the far end. When I emerge, I'm in the sunlight, squinting. I lean my arms up on the stone deck of the pool. A shadow falls over me, and I gaze up directly into Agent Crow's killer stare.
Did you miss me?
He asks, crouching. He's the most dressed down I've ever seen him, in rolled-up casual pants and a short-sleeved cotton shirt.
I came to see you.
He smiles, his steel teeth glinting in the sunlight.
I don't want to see you.
His icy eyes turn colder.
Last time I checked, you're still second-born. I don't need your permission.
Grisham and Reikin wander out onto the pool deck toward us.
Census, Grisham says, do you have information for me?
There's been an interesting development that I thought you might not be aware of, Crow says.
Oh?
It's been reported that the second family of Virtues, the Keatings, have suddenly misplaced their newly minted firstborn heir, Orwell. It's such a shame. Firstborn Rasmussen Keating is murdered. Now his brother is missing. The Keatings will lose their position as second family of Virtues. They might even find themselves having to leave Virtues altogether because they no longer have an heir to guarantee their position in society.
How long has Orwell been gone?
Grisham asks.
A week or more,
Agent Crow replies.
Well, find him.
There's a high probability that he's already dead. No one is getting any feedback from his moniker. I'd like your permission to question Roselle regarding the matter.
Why do you want to question her?
Reikin asks. His voice is calm, but there's tension in his body language.
She's not the next in line for the title. Her mother and her brother are.
Agent Crow frowns. He doesn't like his authority questioned.
I would like to ascertain what, if anything, she knows about the disappearance.
Raiken crosses his arms over his chest.
How can she possibly know anything when she's been here on lockdown for the past 2 weeks?
People go missing all the time, I interject. Why, just a couple of weeks ago, I saw that a secondborn went missing from this very palace. What was his name? Kramer, Clarkston, Cranston, that's it! Cranston Adam. He was a mortician, I believe. You wouldn't happen to know anything about his disappearance, would you, Agent Crow?
Agent Crow looks like he'd like to drown me in the pool. Who did you say?
Cranston Adam, I repeat. It'd be interesting to find out who was the last person to see him alive. I bet someone like him kept records of his appointments. The question that keeps swirling around in my mind is, why would anyone want to hurt a mortician? What could he possibly know that would threaten anyone?
Maybe he's a deserter. Agent Crow's voice is deadly calm.
A man like that? In love with his job?
I don't think so, I insist.
I think he knew something that someone wanted to keep secret.
You have quite an imagination, Agent Crow hisses. Secondborns desert all the time. He'll probably show up in the Gates of Dawn body count. A defector.
I wonder, if he does, will he have a moniker?
A bead of sweat slides down Agent Crow's cheek. His fingers twitch to where his fusion blade should be, but it's not there.
He had to relinquish it before he entered Grisham's private domain, a new security measure that was recently mandated.
You might have made a good census agent, Roselle, Agent Crow says with a chilling look.
Probably not. There's just one person I'd enjoy killing, Agent Crow, but he isn't third-born.
Reagan steps between me and Agent Crow. I believe you have the wrong St. Sismode, he says. If you're attempting to uncover information on the disappearance of Orwell Virtue, you should start with Othala and Gabriel St. Sismode.
This is the second time you've come between me and this second-born, Agent Crow seethes.
Listen, old man, Grisham says. I like your style. It's creepy, and that works for a man like you.
He slaps Agent Crow on the back.
But Winterstrom's right.
You got the wrong St. Sismode.
I can vouch for her. She's been here on lockdown for weeks. We're so bored that any of us might kill Orwell if he shows his face here, just for fun. But he hasn't, and we didn't. So go to the Sword Palace, ask those same questions about Orwell, and then report back to me.
Grisham cuffs him on the shoulder. He turns and winks at me, completely missing the glowering look from Agent Crow.
Very well, Firstborn Commander, Crow caves. I will return with a full report soon.
Grisham is already walking away. He puts up his hand in a dismissive gesture. Raiken doesn't move until Agent Crow disappears down the garden path. Then he turns, glowers at me, and sits down on the pool deck, putting his legs into the water.
What was that all about? Who is Cranston Adam?
The mortician we encountered on our trip to the morgue. He has been missing for 2 weeks.
You didn't bother to tell me?
He grumbles, and then looks in Grisham's direction. The firstborn has returned to the table and is now receiving a massage.
You haven't exactly been talking to me, so no, I didn't bother to tell you. I've been busy.
Okay. Do you have time to talk about it now?
What do you know?
You saw Crow's face when I said the part about the mortician's moniker.
He reached for a weapon that wasn't there.
He's ready to kill to keep a secret.
What secret?
I don't know, but Census and my mother are working together. He came to see if the Halo Palace's guard is down. He wants to take me from here.
You think he's aligned with your mother?
I have no proof, but yes. I've thought it since my father's funeral.
Why haven't you said anything?
His grip on the rim of the pool turns his knuckles a shade lighter.
His handsome face is more forbidding than usual.
Like you said, you've been busy.
I'm never too busy to discuss something as important as this, he growls.
Quincy, the young second-born attendant from Balmora's Sea Fortress, enters the private sanctuary, clad in a summer dress. Her feet are covered in sand. She's met at the door by a member of Grisham's staff, who turns and points to me in the pool. Quincy nods and approaches us.
Roselle Sword, second-born commander requests the pleasure of your company for lunch at her residence today at noon.
Since my father's funeral, I've been spending more and more time with Balmora. She's kind and easy to talk to, even when she's painting the same landscape over and over. It's borderline obsessive-compulsive, but I try not to judge. I do a lot of things most people would find insane, just to keep my panic at bay. Her paintings don't hurt anyone.
Tell her I'll be there at noon, I reply, but I can only stay a short time. I have an appointment with the firstborn commander this afternoon.
Very good.
Quincy sighs with relief and walks away.
You shouldn't grow attached to her,
Raken says. Heaviness settles on my chest as I climb out of the pool.
I could say the same to you about Grisham.
Don't be late for our appointment, Grisham calls to me as I leave.
Balmora is in her private drawing room when I arrive. Inside the lofty, round tower room, scores of paintings of the same seascape, her second-born sea fortress, hang everywhere. Big murals on the walls, small miniatures on the tables.
The moment she looks at me, I know there's something terribly wrong.
Everyone leave us, she bellows in a fine rendition of her father, the Virtue. Her attendants scurry away, closing the doors behind them. The death drones remain hovering near the doors. So do my Virtue stingers.
Balmora opens her palm, revealing a whisper orb. She clicks the device, and an iridescent bubble forms around us. The hovering machines seem not to notice. She motions for me to come closer. I do, and she pulls me into a hug. Her blonde hair smells like sunshine.
I need to ask you for something, but I'm afraid, she whispers.
What is it? I whisper too, though I know I don't have to be quiet.
Please tell me I wasn't wrong. During the attack on your father's funeral procession, you were afraid. Afraid for Gabriel.
I nod.
He's not well, but that doesn't mean he can't get better. Your brother needs help, she insists, and you're the only one I can trust.
I know where he is.
He's in Swords, right?
No. He left Swords after your father's funeral. He couldn't stand it anymore. He's in Virtues.
My hands move to her upper arms.
He can't be here. If your father finds out, he's dead.
Don't you think I know that?
Her eyes narrow to slits.
I'm desperate to protect him from my father. I need you to find him for me and bring him here. I'll hide him until we can figure out how to help him.
Why would you protect him? I ask suspiciously. I know I'm not getting the whole picture here.
Because we're in love.
I stare at her, not sure if she's being honest or delusional.
You don't believe me? She asks. I'm not making it up.
She lifts a small gilt-frame miniature of her sea fortress and shoves it into my hand.
Look at that.
I've seen 100 of them, I say softly, trying not to provoke her.
No, I mean, really look at it, she insists.
I stare at it, trying to see whatever it is in it that she wants me to see. My eyes blur. A gasp hitches my breath, and my heart begins to race. I turn the painting upside down. The negative space forms a profile of Gabriel. The water is his face. The fortress is his neck and torso. My lips part. My head snaps up, and I glance at every landscape in the room. They reveal themselves to be portraits of my brother. Now that I see it, it's as obvious as a six-fingered hand.
He gave me this, she says, pulling a necklace from beneath the fabric of her white sundress.
A ring hangs from the golden chain. It's one of Gabriel's sword-faded rings, very old, small enough to fit on a child's finger.
When Gabriel becomes the sword, he's going to change everything. He's going to marry me. We've been planning it since we were children.
Her voice grows frayed and raw. Tears fill her eyes.
It's always been Gabriel and me. Who do you think he visited when he came here? Grisham? Fat chance.
Scorn twists her face.
It was me. He loves me.
I hug her to me as she sobs.
Shh, I believe you.
She sniffles.
You do?
Yes. What do you want me to do?
My father isn't the only one with spies, Roselle. I've been able to locate Gabriel, but no one is willing to bring your brother here.
Why not?
It would be treason. My father would kill them if he finds out.
Where is he, Balmora?
You'll get him and bring him here?
Her eyes are both pleading and suspicious. Will he come with me? I ask. The last time I saw him, he was certain that I wanted him dead.
Make him come with you, she replies desperately.
Where is he, Balmora? I ask again. Pure fear shows in her eyes. She wants to tell me, but she's terrified of what I'll do with the information. This is her battle. I can't fight it, so I wait silently. Desperation wins out.
He's at Club Faraway. He has a private room under the name Firstborn Solomon, she falters. Solomon.
Solomon Sunday, I murmur.
That's right. How did you know?
When Gabriel and I were really young, 6 and 7, we used to play swords with sticks whenever no one was around to scold us. He'd let me be the heroine, Fabriana Friday. A tear slips from my eye, and my chin wobbles. And he'd be the villain, Solomon Sunday. I wipe the tear away.
I'll find him, and I'll bring him here if I can. I promise. I have an underground network of people who will help, Balmora says, relieved. She takes the miniature from me and sets it back on the table. Next to it rests a small box, which she picks up and hands to me. Inside is an old wrist communicator. With the new monikers, these have become obsolete, but they're perfect for modified communication on frequencies that no one seems to be paying attention to. I've established a private one for you and me. Whatever you need, I'll get it for you.
I need to know how your network operates. Chapter 14. Secondborn Network. The Secondborn training camps are set amid agrarian and sylvan landscapes between purity and lenity. Only the training and pre-trials are held on solid ground. The Secondborn trials will take place on one of the 9 land masses suspended in the air a half mile up. These hovering islands are marvels of engineering. Some are as big as 30 miles across. They contain vegetation and water sources, with wildlife created specifically for whatever challenge each island is to host. Lakes, valleys, mountains, plains, and deserts comprise the terrain, along with horrific hidden quagmires and automated death traps. A single crown-shaped coliseum levitates in the center, above the floating islands. Made of glass and steel, the silver halo hosts the opening and closing ceremonies. Shadows from the floating behemoths above us blot out large areas of sunlight on the training fields below, like a shadow of doom over the Secondborn competitors. To compensate, mounted light grids shine down from beneath the floating structures, but the additional light the floating islands provide is much dimmer than direct sunlight. The training fields are sectioned into fan-shaped areas designated by number, and they meet around a circle reserved for the enjoyment of firstborns. The only secondborns allowed in are those who work there or are accompanied by a firstborn of the aristocracy, like I am. Raken offers me his hand as I climb out of his 2-seater airship. My halo stingers hover outside, having followed Raken's vehicle to the training grounds. Along with Raken, the 2 stingers comprise my security team, and they're the only reason I was granted permission to leave the Halo Palace without Exo guards in tow. Grisham isn't so lucky. His airship lands next to ours. 15 exoguards and a handful of halo stingers alight from his vehicle and the several surrounding it. The exos, thankfully, are not my problem.
The levitating hover pad gives us an aerial view of the training facilities that stretch out before us for miles. Weapons training is in the section nearest to where we're standing. Pyrotechnics is farther afield, identifiable by the mushroom-shaped dirt clouds in the distance. Obstacle courses are to the east and west. Special operations pavilions freckle the terrain. The most curious courses hide under dome enclosures, presumably to regulate temperature. One contains a mountain range, the other a desert. Dressed in stylish training fatigues, as if he'll be participating, Grisham bounces boisterously toward us, throwing his arms wide. "Welcome to the ultimate test of champions." He grasps me by the upper arms. "I wish I were you, Roselle, getting to experience it all for the first time. What I wouldn't give." He grins like a madman. "I wish you could be me, too," I murmur, "and experience everything a secondborn goes through." Raiken puts his hand on Grisham's shoulder, pulling him off me.
"Who do you want to look at first?"
"I don't know. There are so many. I'll have to consult my brackets."
He touches his golden halo, activating the moniker. The firstborns herd me toward a line of waiting hoverbikes. I've never driven one, so I ride with Raiken. He mounts the hovering beast. It reminds me of him, black from fender to fender, like his brooding personality. Sleek and forward-leaning, clearly fast and agile. When Raiken starts the cycle, it purrs. He touches the throttle, and it growls deep, vibrating the ground where I stand. It feels as dangerous as the man himself. Grisham's cycle is pure gold, shiny and overstated. Our security force has silver cycles. Some jet off ahead of us to secure the route. Others fan out to our sides and behind us. Raiken gives me a side-eyed look.
"Do you plan on walking, or are you going to get on?"
I straddle the seat behind him, glad that I wore a black jacket, tight white shirt, black leggings, and tall black boots. My feet rest on pegs behind me, forcing me to lean forward, my knees hugging Raiken's thighs. I place my hands on my own thighs rather than touch his.
"Put your arms around my waist," Raiken orders over his shoulder, "or you'll fall, and I'll have to scrape you off the ground."
"I'd never fall," I scoff. "I have excellent balance."
It sounds like a boast, but it's true.
"You lean a little to the right when you hold your fusion blade at a 70-degree angle," Raiken prods. My gaze should melt his back, but it doesn't.
"That's because I have to compensate for the crooked elbow on your weak left arm."
Raiken chuckles. "My elbow is perfect, and I will arm wrestle you with my left arm anytime you say. Now hold my waist, and try not to fall off."
I slip my arms around him. He's solid muscle. When he leans back unexpectedly, the soft fabric of his shirt brushes my cheek. The scent of him is disturbing. I want to rest against his back and inhale deeper. I grit my teeth.
"Ready?" he asks.
"Of course." We jet forward, going from 0 to 200 miles an hour in seconds. If I weren't holding on to him, I'd be broken. As it is, a small backrest rose behind me and caught some of the force. My arms cinch tighter to Raiken's waist, and I mold my chest against his back. I can feel him chuckling. I settle in. My arms loosen a bit. The hover cycle is exquisite for an adrenaline junkie like me. Wind whips through my hair. All I can think about is going faster. Security trails us, and so do my halo stingers, as we take a lap around the perimeter of a fan-shaped training field. The obstacle course is mostly wooded, about 15 miles in circumference. Perilous paths through the trees jet off from the firstborn observatory track that we cruise. Massive redwoods tower above our heads. Sunlight filters through the branches as we fly by makeshift shanties constructed of pine boughs, thatches of limbs, and toppled tree trunks. Secondborns in the contest aren't living off the land yet, but they're learning how. Exposure and dehydration will kill around 20% of the contestants in the first couple of weeks. It's an agonizing way to die. The truth is that, even though they're the property of the government, most of them wouldn't know how to exist without it. They're institutionalized.
Reagan increases our altitude and slows the hover cycle. We arrive at a hover pad outside an observatory in Flabellet 1, part of the elaborate, interconnected set of tree forts high in the canopy. Grisham is the first one off his bike, heading straight for the rope bridges to the main treetop fortress. Reagan stays with me, walking by my side. I look around, growing more and more annoyed. The observatory is really an adult playground, where firstborns can be pampered by stone-fated secondborn domestics while they watch the participants of the trials struggle to hone their survival skills. Beside the observatory, with its aerial views of the clearing below, sword-fated secondborn commanders who will not be competing in the trials give live demonstrations. Targeting games are set up high in the canopies, so firstborns can test their own skills with various weapons. When a firstborn's aim strays, live ammunition finds its way down to the fields where the secondborns train. Grisham beckons us to the central observation deck.
"Tourists," he growls, shunning the other activities with a scornful sneer. "You're ruining the sport," he shouts at the nearest firstborns, with their hunting crossbows and grenade-tipped arrowheads.
The security team starts to manhandle the firstborns, and they scurry off to a different target, leaving us alone on the observation deck. The hovering platform is made of a lightweight material with the look of wood. It blends in with the surroundings. The open face is guarded by an invisible, restrictive energy field that allows airflow but prevents anyone from falling off the edge and plummeting to a horrifying death. Grisham passes out enhanced telescopic eyewear, and I'm able to observe the combatants on the field below us as if I'm standing right above them. He points out his favorites. He has a surprising understanding of their skill sets and knows details down to their vitamin supplements. One combatant is his particular favorite, a man by the name of McGregor Sword. He's a red-headed 23-year-old man of epic proportions. I note that McGregor holds back from aggressive training today. I mention as much to Grisham.
"It's strategy," Grisham says with assurance. "He doesn't want others to know how skilled he is."
"It's pain, Grisham," I reply, "not strategy. He likely has a hamstring tear. See the back of his left leg? Notice how the muscle looks lumpy? It's going to pop soon, and he'll be useless until it's fixed. He's probably taking all kinds of medications to numb it. Look at the way he's clenching his jaw and favoring his other leg. An injury like that is excruciating and takes a few days to recover from once the muscle is reconstructed. He only has a few days left until the opening ceremonies. It may not be enough time, and that's if he has the merits to get it repaired. But he can't back out, can he? Once he committed, he's in whether he wants to be or not." That part I say with no small amount of scorn. Grisham must think my scorn is for McGregor because he says,
"What a scam artist. I bet the odd makers are counting on him keeping his mouth shut about his injury so they can capitalize on it."
"Why would he reveal it?" Reagan asks sarcastically. His eyes look right through Grisham.
"It would let his adversaries know how to attack him effectively." "Well, you both need to keep it to yourselves," Grisham demands. "Uncovering the winner is only a small part of this. There are other bets along the way, like who won't survive certain challenges."
"Is there a way out of this for him, Grisham?" I ask. "McGregor probably enlisted in the trials when he was healthy. Now he'll likely be killed in a gruesome exhibition."
"He chose this. He must live with it. Come to think of it, he has to die with it, too,"
Grisham quips. Violence touches every part of my life. It's unavoidable. It's in every breath I take. Watching the competitors train, I begin to loathe myself for not using all my resources to put an end to it. They might have chosen to enroll in the secondborn trials, as Grisham says, but doing so is a suicide note to the world. "You've brought my spirit to its knees, and now you may rip apart my body as well." Some probably believe they have a chance, but most know they don't.
They just want their pain to end. Grisham logs everything I say on his moniker. After we exhaust this field of competitors, Grisham is anxious to move on. Mounting the hover cycles, we fly to the next section, staying close to the ground as we ride. I rest my cheek against Raken's back. We pass a small lake, and the air suddenly gets cooler. Passing meadows, the wind grows sweet with lush flowering plants. I'm disappointed when we get to Flablet too. I'd rather keep riding, bumping over pockets of air, letting the tension of this world ebb. Flablet 2 is hauntingly similar. After it, we tour the other sections until the sun sets and the competitors are excused to scrounge for meals. Grisham suggests we take a break and find some food ourselves. Mounting the hover cycles once more, we fly to the center of the training matrix. The fan-shaped training fields encircle the trial village. Raken slows the hover bike as we near the epicenter for Firstborns and the media, a wooded glade filled with fantastical architecture and surrounded by gleaming walls of fusion energy. Round orbs of light float above and cast a glow over the bustling crowds. Security is tight here at the enormous arching stone portico to the modern medieval village. Armed exos stop us at the entrance. As part of Grisham's entourage, we're waved through. But others, those not high enough on the aristocratic ladder, are turned away. Grisham and Raken park their vehicles. Raken's hand drops from the throttle. His fingers skim the outside of my thigh. The gesture is possessive, even if it's brief. He climbs off the bike and extends his hand to me. This suddenly feels very intimate. I'm not sure why. He's told me that he doesn't care about me. I should listen. Raken always means every word he utters, but it's confusing nonetheless. I decline his help and climb off on my own. A cool wind blows through the trees, rustling the needle leaves. A gorgeous starry night peeks through the redwood canopy. Paved paths lined with wrought iron lampposts branch in several directions. I pull my jacket closer around me. "Are you cold?" Raken asks. His dark hair is windswept, but no less attractive for that. I shake my head. "No, I'm fine." A festival atmosphere prevails. Dressed for clubbing, the throng around us is jovial, thrill-seeking. I've never been in a crowd this happy before. Firstborns are dance-walking, moving to the beat of live instruments. Glitter tints the women's hair and skin in vibrant colors, with small holographic fireworks displays bursting around them like crowning laurels. Strings of holographic bluebirds fly around the heads of others. Some men sport holographic angel wings that flutter with white light. Others carry miniature holographic monsters that sit reaper-like on their shoulders and lurch out at passing women, whose screams mix giddy fascination with surprised terror. Unsettled by the strangeness of it all, I reach for my fusion blade, but I don't have one on me. I feel exposed. Raken's hand brushes mine as we walk. He seems closer than normal. I can still feel his shape against me, and I wonder if he feels mine. The paved path forces us closer still as we follow Grisham, surrounded by his security force. I recognize a famous face as it passes. Firstborn Gerard Hampton, a diamond-fated actor who plays a secondborn sword in a popular drama. He's with a virtue-fated firstborn woman I don't recognize. He recognizes me, though. He says my name and gives me a soldier's salute as we pass. It makes me want to crush him. He's clueless about what it's like to be secondborn. We see more film stars and musicians. Some are working, but most are here as spectators. Everyone steps to the side for the heir to the fate of virtues, and they whisper about us behind their hands after we pass. Drone cameras and news crews occupy live coverage booths, and roaming commentators narrate the ongoing action for a worldwide audience. The carnival atmosphere extends to the vendors. Salloway Munitions Conglomerate has a multi-level, interactive showroom in the Trial Village, prominently featuring the latest in advanced domestic weaponry for the private sector. The featured weapon is the new Culprit 44, complete with neon-tinted energy filters that render hydrogen rounds in a variety of rainbow colors.
My holographic image runs through the mock battlefield on the outside of the Salloway showroom, acrobatically maneuvering and destroying fake enemies. My cheeks feel hot as I watch it. Raiken gently squeezes my waist, but I pull away. I don't need his sympathy. I do what I do to survive. In that, I regret nothing. We keep walking. Around every bend is a fanciful bronze water fountain composed of statues of victorious second-born competitors. Most are depicted in their final challenge, along with the loser at the defining moment of victory. One stands before us with his bronze fist entwined in the hair of a severed head, holding it aloft. Glorious? Maybe. Gruesome? Definitely. I'm glad that we don't linger. We come to a restaurant in the shape of a spike of barley several stories high. Made of gold-painted steel and gold-tinted glass, each barleycorn on the stalk boasts a private room with its own chef, Grisham informs us. We're escorted to the golden elevator and taken up to a tear-shaped private room. An exquisite table is prepared on the edge of a balcony. The smell of fresh-baked bread surrounds us. Raiken helps me off with my jacket, handing it to a waiter. He pulls out my chair for me. I sit beside him, across from Grisham. Beer and wine are served in abundance. Appetizers on wooden trays litter the table. Meats and cheeses melt in my mouth, and I think about how much Hammond and Edgerton would love this place. Grisham, Raiken, and I enjoy a quiet meal together with our security team discreetly hanging back in strategic positions. Grisham does most of the talking, discussing the champions while he devours a rare steak and a half a loaf of bread. Raiken watches me. The candlelight of the table casts a certain smolder in his eyes, like light from the setting sun on water. Shadows play upon his black hair and the angular planes of his face. He looks dangerous. The communicator hidden on my upper arm keeps softly vibrating, alerting me to Balmora's attempts to contact me. Placing my napkin on the table, I murmur, "Gentlemen, please excuse me." I rise, and Raiken does too. Grisham settles back in his seat. "May I remind you that she's second-born?" he teases. I follow the corridor to the bathroom. My halo stingers scan it before allowing me in alone. Once inside, I lock the door. From inside my sleeve, I pull down the wrist communicator, its face shining with blue light, and contact Balmora. "You're at the Barleycorn?" Balmora's holographic image says as soon as she answers. She's tracking me. "I am. I've arranged for your transport to Club Faraway. Your contact is second-born Franklin Starr. He's a drone operator for the Daily Diamond. He'll take you there in less than an hour. You have to meet him at the news hover van." "You're kidding," I ask, frustrated. "I'm surrounded by Grisham and his security." "You're going to have to lose them." Her voice is brittle with anxiety. I exhale deeply. "Where's the hover van?"
"Sending you the coordinates now."
I study the holographic map. It isn't far. The problem is losing my entourage, getting there alone, and trying not to be recognized along the way.
"I'm going to need a weapon. Fusion blade, preferably." "I'll see what I can do," Balmora says. "I'll be in touch with you after I make contact."
I end the transmission and push the communicator back into my upper sleeve. Returning to the table, I find the men ready to leave. Grisham, in particular, is anxious to get to the betting houses. He goes over his potential wagers with me while I don my jacket and Raiken pays the bill. In the elevator, Raiken's hand presses the small of my back. Possessive. I wonder about it until we reach the ground floor. Grisham insists that we go to the Neon Bible, the high-end bookmaking establishment a few doors away. The indoor-outdoor betting house thumps with action. As we approach the entrance, Raiken turns to Grisham, saying,
"I have to check on something. Keep an eye on the second-born for me."
Annoyed, Grisham sputters, "Can't it wait? I want to get my brackets set before I'm locked out of the odds for the evening."
"I'll be just a minute. There's a weapon at Salloway's that I've had my eye on for months. Just watch her for me."
Grisham gives me a scowl
as if I'm some sort of child thrust upon him.
Fine, but be quick, he growls. I'm not placing bets for you.
Reagan walks away with a secretive